Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Safely to Earth, The Men and Women Who Brought the Astronauts Home, by Jack Clemens, narrated by Tom Perkins. In a very real sense, it will not be one man going to the moon. It will be an entire nation, for all of us must work to put him there. President John F. Kennedy to a joint session of Congress, May 25, 1961. 1. Pre-flight briefing. On November 14, 1969, lightning struck Apollo 12 Saturn V rocket at liftoff at the Kennedy Space Center, knocking many of the spacecraft's critical electrical power systems offline. This set off emergency alarms and a flood of warning lights, and caused a vast amount of erroneous and inexplicable data to be displayed to both the astronauts and the ground controllers in Houston. It also left the Apollo command module, now departing for the moon with batteries capable of only about 3 hours of power. Neither the astronauts nor the mission control team knew about the lightning strike, so they were in the dark about what had happened. Only quick and clear thinking by NASA's John Aaron, a young flight controller in Houston's manned spacecraft center, brought the onboard systems back online and avoided a potentially catastrophic mission abort. John had recognized a pattern in the inconsistent numbers being displayed that indicated one of the onboard electronic systems had shut down. He quickly requested that the crew place an obscure cockpit switch, called signal conditioning electronics, into its auxiliary position. Once the SCE was switched to aux, all of the spacecraft's correct data were restored, revealing the underlying problem, which allowed John to inform the crew of the actions needed to restore full power to their spacecraft. Apollo 12 went on to carry the third and fourth human beings to walk on the moon and return them safely to Earth. John Aaron is just one of the remarkable professionals who were central to achieving this nation's voyage of humans into space, landing on the moon, and later making the space shuttle fly. He and many other outstanding men and women played critical roles in the early success of NASA's manned space program flights, and, more important, ensured that the astronauts who flew them returned home safely. The stories that follow will acquaint you with a number of these individuals and reintroduce you to John. Many such extraordinary people inhabit this account, a diary that chronicles my time working beside them as part of that adventure. 2. Prep for launch. But why, some say, the moon? On September 12, 1962, President John F. Kennedy gave his now famous "We Choose to Go to the Moon" speech at Rice University in Houston, Texas. On that sweltering day, he asked his audience a question, "But why, some say, the moon?" I've been asked a version of this question many times over the years. I've heard enthusiasts and apologists alike respond by citing the thrill of exploration, the Cold War, a quest for scientific understanding, the commercialization of Teflon, and the invention of integrated circuits. Neither of the latter two is right, though one study found that every dollar spent by NASA on research and development ultimately returns $7 of value to the gross national product. But that day, President Kennedy answered his question with what, for me, is the most compelling argument. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. So it did. By accepting that challenge, NASA and the nation energized the imagination and spirit of a younger generation of Americans who embraced the study of engineering and the sciences, and many of whom took part in the president's grand enterprise. I was one of those. So when I'm asked what benefit came from the Apollo program, I now respond, me and hundreds of others like me who answered the president's call. Apollo was the great adventure of our age. Though numerous books and films have celebrated the achievement, when people discover I had a part in it, their first question is often, what was it like? Even after all this time, interest in Project Apollo seems undiminished. My answer is a personal one. I describe how I experience the program as a newly minted rocket scientist and offer a glimpse through the narrow window my role provided into an unprecedented human undertaking. I find that when I talk about the tasks assigned to me on Apollo and the world of technology available in the 1960s, people get a sense of the rest of it, and an appreciation for the staggering responsibility shouldered by the men and women of NASA and the private contractors who brought those parts together and put human footprints on the moon. Because, of course, I was only one of many. The efforts of the teams I worked with were integrated with those of scores of professionals, all applying their specialized skills to the construction of these systems. Hundreds of thousands of men and women working in offices and factories and research centers and launch sites and tracking stations and military bases and on Navy ships around the world added their talents to make Apollo a success. They were largely unfamiliar with our work. They had to trust us to take the same care as they did to ensure that all components worked together when called upon. When, at last, human footprints were imprinted on the moon, many of those people who had pioneered mankind's first ventures into space went on to apply their hard-won experiences to developing the space shuttle, a way for humans to work and live in space and study the wondrous universe from a vantage point once only dreamed of. I'm proud of the programs on which I worked, of the people whom I met and learned from and became friends with, and of what we accomplished for human spaceflight. I'll describe some of that work here, sketch a few portraits of those unknown pioneers, put on exhibit the tools they used, many now considered primitive, and explain the risks they took and the mistakes they made in producing these brilliant creations. These are little-told tales of the people who fashioned the computer programs that accompanied the human crews on these spacecraft, and of the astronauts who relied on them for the directions to their destination, for the guidance on how to get there, and for control of their fate during the journey. And when the space travelers completed their often perilous tasks to return them safely to the Earth. In the opening of his 1947 novel, Tales of the South Pacific, James Michener wrote, "They will live a long time, these men of the South Pacific. They had an American quality. They, like their victories, will be remembered as long as our generation lives. After that, like the men of the Confederacy, they will become strangers. Longer and longer shadows will obscure them until their Guadalcanal sounds distant on the ear, like Shiloh and Valley Forge." So, I fear, could be the fate of the men and women who committed their energies and passions to provide humankind the promise of journeying beyond the narrows of Earth. As the years pass into decades, and the technology we used seems increasingly akin to Stone Age hammerstones and flint flakes, let these people not become strangers. 3. Countdown. I'm a dreamer, not an engineer. For my 6th birthday, my dad gave me a brand new erector set, and from that day on I knew I wanted to be an engineer. Nope. That was never me. A popular misconception is that we rocket scientists are a nerdy bunch, obsessed from the time we learned to read with building toys that fly. While that was the case for some, including an astronaut friend of mine, it wasn't true for me or for a number of other engineers and technical people I know. It wasn't our degree, but rather an early enthusiasm for human spaceflight that we shared, and which, given the opportunity, propelled us to be part of it. As an example, here's a little background to illustrate the improbable route I took to work on the Apollo Moon program. I know a number of professionals who traveled equally unlikely paths. It is true that I got an erector set when I turned 6. I remember unwrapping the rectangular metal box, painted red except for a drawing on the lid of a kid my age staring at some metal contraption he'd put together. I unlatched the hasps and lifted the lid and found a mystifying assembly of thin metal beams with holes drilled through them and wheels and a whole lot of screws and a key-wound motor and some printed directions, all neatly tucked into the spaces inside. I played with it for a time. I built a few simple towers that wouldn't quite stay upright, and a wind-up crane that didn't lift. I wasn't good at getting the joints to fit, so I spent more time constructing wobbly metal toys than playing with them. After a couple of weeks, I put everything back in the box and never opened it again. I don't remember seeing it after third grade when we moved to the other side of town. I didn't build model rockets when I was a teen either, though one of my friends did, and I watched him fire one off, worrying the wind would blow it backward and onto me. I did have a chemistry set that I kept in the basement, but I only remember a concoction of powders that I mixed together in a mason jar. Somehow it got wet and exploded one day while I was at school. My mom threw out the box and its chemicals before I got home. I didn't miss them. My dad did all the repairs around the house. He even converted our attic space into a really nice bedroom for my sister. I tried helping him once or twice, but both times he ended up yelling at me to just get out of the way. He used to tell me, "You better get an education, because if you have to earn a living using your hands, you'll starve to death." He said that quite a lot. So, no, I didn't always want to be an engineer. In fact, the thought of actually building something was daunting. Mostly, I was a reader. I started with comic books, usually Batman and Superman, but some Scrooge McDuck, too. My dad had been a state policeman for a time, and he opened his own private detective agency when I was in middle school. That's when I discovered the Hardy Boys. I read all 34 books that were available when I was 11. I guess I was hoping my dad would take me out with him on one of his cases, like Fenton Hardy did with his sons. My father wasn't persuaded, and that didn't happen either. I even wrote 10, mercifully, short stories called The Adventure Boys, complete with my hand-drawn illustrations that featured me and my best friend at the time, Jim Ziegler, solving crimes with my father. One story had the melodramatic and derivative title, The Clue of the Feathered Signet. I still have a couple of those, which I guess is a measure of how even then my interest was in writing and dreaming, not in building. By the time I reached middle school, I'd outgrown both comics and the Hardy Boys, and a classmate friend introduced me to science fiction. I discovered Isaac Asimov's Robots, Ray Bradbury's Mars, and Arthur C. Clarke's Moon. I was transfixed. It wasn't the science so much as the call to adventure that appealed to me, though the likelihood of it ever being real back then wasn't too removed from believing that Batman could fight crime from a cave. In 1957, my older sister Mary married a young man named Bob Sunday, who literally changed my views on that. Bob was a U.S. Army veteran who had served in combat duty as a tank driver in the Korean War. He was a professional artist, a skilled concert organist, an avid photographer, and most important for me, an enthusiastic amateur astronomer. Bob was 12 years my senior, and when I was an early teen, he taught me to use his telescope and showed me wonders of the night sky, the stars of the Pleiades, the rings of Saturn, and the craters on the moon. I've credited him often as being one of the two most influential people in my life, the other being John F. Kennedy, who inspired my interest in space and fueled my desire to be part of the team who put human beings on the moon. That's where things stood when I went off to college in 1961. After my sister married, my mother and father moved from Pennsylvania to Florida in 1958 so that my dad could take a police officer's job in a small beach town. I was a good enough student in high school to get a 4-year scholarship to the University of Florida, but I was a thimble-fingered dreamer with little appetite for building gadgets and little skill at other pursuits. And I was still adrift about what I wanted to be when I grew up. I could do advanced math well enough when I put my mind to it, but I never liked it, an indifference that continues to this day. Yet, 6 years later, I was an engineer working to get the first human beings on the moon safely home. My message is, judge your future engineer by her passions, not by her toys. Chasing Apollo. Two events occurred while I was in college that changed the direction of my life. The first was in 1962 when I was starting my sophomore year. I still wasn't sure where to direct my studies. In those days, you didn't have to make that decision until you started your junior year. Freshman and sophomore years were dedicated to rounding out your education. History, the humanities, writing and public speaking, chemistry and economics, all were part of the curriculum. I knew that a college degree was the key to unlock many doors, but I didn't know which ones I wanted to open. I thought about majoring in writing, though it was certainly not a profession where one might earn much of a living unless I could become the next Bradbury or Asimov. Then, on September 12, 1962, John F. Kennedy challenged us, all of us, to go to the moon, and I was electrified. The future I'd read about, that I'd so often imagined, was suddenly on its way, and I could be part of making it happen. As I said, I'd done okay in math and science, but that was just schoolwork, where I'd learned to pass the tests. Now I had a spur for my enthusiasm, a direction. The mysterious and challenging specifics of the advanced sciences and complex calculus were tools I'd have to master if I wanted to play a part in it. I changed my major to aerospace engineering, then a newly created program of study, and learned to compute the odd behavior of satellites in orbit and to calculate the heat of friction on the surface of a supersonic aircraft. If I got my degree in time, I could be part of achieving President Kennedy's goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. The second change that happened that year was that I made an unexpected and ultimately aborted decision to become an officer in the United States Army. Our country's engagement in the Vietnam War started in 1961, and all young men over the age of 18 were required to register for the draft. The war escalated all through the 1960s, and so did the number of men who were drafted. When I arrived at Florida in 1961, the biggest campus rage against authority was the so-called panty raid on the women's dormitories, basically a boisterous crowd of beer-swilling males clustering on the lawn outside the windows and daring the girls to show their underwear. By the time I left, 6 years later, university administrators were calling in the Gainesville City Police to disperse the masses of angry, rioting students who were protesting the war. Though the Selective Service had granted a temporary draft exemption for college students, that protection was rescinded for graduates and dropouts. It looked increasingly likely that my career in aerospace was going to be delayed by a 2-year stint as an infantryman. I'd already discovered that a University of Florida engineering degree then took not 4, but 5 years, which had pushed out my chance to join the space race to 1966. But with the draft, I was now looking at 1968, which meant I'd probably get in only at the tail end of it all. Avoiding service wasn't an option, so I decided at least to do it on my terms, and in my hopelessly naive understanding of what war was like, thinking I'd increase my odds of getting through it in one piece. The University of Florida had a robust Reserve Officers Training Corps, ROTC, program at that time. Every male student was required to take 2 years of Army or Air Force training, and if you spent 4 years, you could graduate as an officer. At the end of my sophomore year in 1963, that's what I decided to do. Though I didn't know it at the time, my experiences the following summer would change all that. A high school friend, Henry Hirsch, who was one of my college roommates and working toward a medical degree, thought it would round out my engineering focus to get more involved with real people. Boy, was he wrong. At his suggestion, I took a job during the summer break as an orderly in a public hospital in Fort Lauderdale. I was assigned to a ward dedicated to elderly end-of-life patients, and it was a disaster. Many of those people had no one who came to visit them, and they were both needy of and grateful for any kind or concerned attention. To their credit, the hospital nursing staff there were wonderful in that way. But for me, working with those desperately lonely and ailing older men and women who looked forward to my just saying hello in the morning reawakened a distressing self-doubt. It didn't help that my responsibilities included more than just changing sheets. I was also tasked with administering a few medical procedures, like inserting and removing catheters in bedridden male patients. This would only be done by a nurse or physician today. One Monday morning, I came in to work to learn that an elderly male patient I'd been caring for daily for almost 2 months had died over the weekend. He had been in decline before I started work there. Yet I was overwhelmed by a troubling, if unfounded, anxiety that somehow I hadn't done enough to prevent his death. I couldn't focus on my job. I second-guessed even my most routine duties. I was a mess. I resigned at the end of that week. Taking off the rest of summer helped, but it was hard to shake off the sudden tumble I'd taken. I was still a bit frazzled in September 1963 when I returned to start my junior year. I enrolled, as planned, in Advanced Army ROTC, which would grant me a second lieutenant's commission when I graduated. While there was patriotism involved, I was one of Kennedy's children, after all. It was also an act of precaution. Then, in November, President Kennedy was assassinated. JFK was my inspiration, the embodiment of a hope-filled future for me, and now he had been murdered. It's hard to convey how that event conspired with my already unsettled confidence to overwhelm me emotionally at that point in my life. My grades faltered, threatening my scholarship. There was only one obligation that forced me to stay in the moment, to get over myself, and that was Army ROTC. The training and drills and discipline demanded of me wouldn't brook inattention or disinterest. If I failed there, I was headed for the draft. By the end of my junior year, I had pretty much pulled it together. During the summer, between my junior and senior years, I was required to attend Army ROTC officers' training camp at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. It was, essentially, an abbreviated boot camp, with all of the physical challenges that implies. I drove up there with my close friend from high school, and now a college roommate, Paul Cherries, who had also chosen to graduate as an officer. I never made it through the first day physicals. When asked to fill out a psychological evaluation questionnaire, for example, "Have you experienced significant emotional distress over the last 12 months?" I checked yes in too many boxes. That sent me to a medical officer who served as the base psychiatrist. I explained my difficulty in dealing with my temporary job as a hospital orderly and chose to omit saying anything about my reaction to JFK's death. I also insisted that it was now all behind me. The doctor asked me if I could be certain it wouldn't recur when I was leading a platoon into battle. It was a horrible prospect to envision. Men under my command might die, and I'd have to deal with that. It was the hospital all over again. "I don't think so," I said. He didn't look convinced and asked, "But could it happen?" I didn't answer him. He made a note and told me he was going to reject me as an officer candidate. I was deflated. Army ROTC had helped to restore me. It had improved my self-confidence. I really needed to be a part of it. I told him that I wanted to serve somehow, but I didn't want to go home and then get drafted. He assured me I wouldn't be, and he classified me 4F. Unfit for military service. That was the end of my brief military career. I went back to school in the fall of 1964. 18 months later, I finished my Bachelor of Science in Aerospace Engineering and promptly married Barbara Porter, a University of Florida graduate I'd known since high school, who'd just earned her teaching degree. Since my 4F draft classification meant I now had additional time to chase my dream job, I stayed on for another year to earn a Master of Science with a specialty in high-speed aerodynamics. In other words, the dynamics of a spacecraft's re-entry through the Earth's atmosphere. In June 1967, I officially became a rocket scientist. I could join the moon team now, with nearly 3 years left until the end of the decade. But the consequences of my revised draft status continued to reverberate. I applied for a job at several aerospace companies, all of which were doing significant hiring in response to the U.S. space program and to the ongoing Cold War with the USSR. With my newly minted degrees, I thought I was an ideal candidate. None of them offered me a job. I came to find out that my 4F classification, unfit for military service, had scared them off. One company claimed that it would prohibit me from obtaining a U.S. government security clearance, which was required for any classified work they might later assign to me. Just why they thought that is still a mystery, since it subsequently proved to be untrue. All but one company, General Electric, turned me down. So my first engineering job after graduating from college took me well off course from my plan to work on the Apollo program. On July 5, 1967, I was hired by General Electric's Missile and Space Division outside Philadelphia, and my new wife and I relocated to an apartment in Audubon, Pennsylvania. GE was under contract to the U.S. Air Force to design a nose cone for an intercontinental ballistic missile, just in case we had to nuke the Soviets. The work was classified, of course, but in spite of the trepidations of my rejectors, my secret clearance was quickly approved in less than a month. My suitability to qualify for classified work never again came up during the rest of my career. Ironically, here I was, doing the very kind of work that companies working on the space program had denied me. But they were going to the moon, and I wasn't. My first assignment at GE was to work out the detailed mathematical aerodynamics of superheated air flowing around the flat end of something shaped like a bullet that came screaming through the atmosphere at nearly 20 times the speed of sound. A nuclear warhead, for example. It was exhilarating. It certainly provided a robust run-through of my newly earned credentials, and was a lot more difficult than any of the classroom problems I'd wrestled with at Florida. Surprisingly, considering my distaste for mathematics, it was fun, because now working the math wasn't the point. It was just one of the utensils in my engineering toolkit. I diligently labored over the problem for several weeks, even spending overtime hours and a couple of Saturdays on it. Yet in the end, I was able to solve only part of the problem, a sort of first draft. I realized I wasn't going to get any further. Knowing I'd flunked my first test at work, and prepared to be told so, I took the results to my manager, Lonnie Marshall, an African-American with an advanced engineering degree and one of the two or three best managers in my 40-year career. He looked over my work, nodded a little, and to my relief encouraged me on the progress I'd made. It turned out this was a thorny problem that, as yet, no one had successfully cracked. The strategy was to assign it to a newly hired and eager-to-please engineer who wouldn't be hampered by not knowing how hard it was. Lonnie was kind enough not to tell me whether I'd done any better than my predecessors. My time at GE involved the most complex technical work of my career. It even resulted in my first publication in a technical journal. When I tried to reread it recently, I discovered I could no longer keep up with the math it required. But by that time, it was already 1968, and not what I'd imagined I'd be doing when I'd responded to President Kennedy's call. Then the aftermath of a horrific accident a year earlier and 1,000 miles away came around to change my life yet again.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?